Morning to all of you again. Say hello to those of you logged in. David informed me this morning that we can now broadcast to smartphones as well, so technology continues to improve. Today we're going to look at Daniel chapter 5, and I've provided you with a Bible study handout that is actually a copy of what was archived in our Bible reading program. And it goes into a lot of detail about the technicalities and the historical background of Daniel chapter 5. Most notably, it mentions that these chapters are not necessarily in chronological order. This occurred, for example, chapter 5 comes after the events that are described in chapter 8. But in any case, I provided that for you so that you can take a look at that. I'll comment from it a little bit, but I think it is more helpful to study technical details if you have a written piece of material in front of you. I was reminded this week that studies show that people only retain, when you're talking, only 7% is of what you say, and I thought, I have to stop talking as much. People aren't listening anyway, so. the fact is that when we communicate, only 7% is the words, and I forget the other sections, but your body language, how it is presented, makes a bigger statement than the actual words. What I want to do is, as we look at Daniel chapter 5, is to ponder the tremendous lessons that are embedded in it that are relevant for us as individuals, but also for prideful nations and leaders today. A common theme that goes throughout the recorded occurrences in the Old and New Testament is God tends to intervene in dramatic ways when His name and His power and His sovereignty is called into question. That happened with Nebuchadnezzar when he was banished, as we read in the previous chapter. That happened when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fiery furnace. It wasn't about them, it was about God's name, God's reputation, and people calling that into question. And that, to me, is a very relevant topic today, because God's name is maligned in so many different ways, or maligned or ignored or completely dispensed with, because there's an atheistic view of the world. It wasn't really that much difference, because what we'll see here is they were worshiping the gods of what? Gold, silver, bronze, and wood. And we look at that and we think, well, that was kind of simplistic. These folks back then were unsophisticated is perhaps a better word. What do we do today? I mean, who are the gods that Wall Street worships? If it isn't gold, silver, and bronze, the precious metals, the commodities that are traded at all-time highs right now, because our paper currency has been so devalued by simply printing more. I think gold's in the $1,700 an ounce range right now. I remember when it was $200 or $300. That shows you how much our money has been devalued, and it also shows that today we still worship the gods of gold, silver, and bronze. So with that background, let's take a look at the chapter. In verse 1, Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So, a couple of things to note here, and it's highlighted in the handout as well. The word father, and some in my Bible actually notes it in the margin, can refer to ancestor, because Belshazzar was not the son of Nebuchadnezzar. I think he was, might have been his grandson. But the issue here is that he gave command to bring the holy vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple of God to be used in at this big party. And I think that's probably putting it kindly. Orgy may be a better description. So you have a conflict starting, applying what God owns, and rather taking what God claimed to be his own, the holy vessels, and utilizing them at an event that was clearly ungodly. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem. At this point, the temple, the first temple that Solomon had built, had been destroyed, that had been in Jerusalem, and the kings and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. Commodities. You know, it's not that different today. The almighty dollar, the gods of gold and silver demand certain things, don't they? The shareholders, as we put it, demand performance. The shareholders have an appetite that continues to grow year by year. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on a plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hip were loosened, and his knees knocked against each other. He was pretty shook up. Now, I think we would also be a little bit worried if we were having Sabbath services, and all of a sudden, up here behind me, a dismembered hand would appear and start writing on the wall. I think it's safe to say that we would also be about to faint. But that's what happened. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote, and the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts were troubled, so that the joints of his hip were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. The king cried aloud to bring in the learned, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. And the king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck. And he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." So, his solution was to call upon the power of the gods of gold and silver to motivate an astrologer to give him an interpretation. They couldn't do it. Now, if you read the handout, it talks about the fact that it was, in fact, a difficult interpretation because the words that were written could have been interpreted even at simply a language, etymological, and grammatical standpoint, could have been interpreted several ways. It was not clear. You know, back then they didn't write with, vowels. So, depending on which vowel points you insert, it could have been a couple of different things. They were stumped. They didn't know. And even though they were offered great power and wealth, I mean, the other side of it, of course, was if someone ventured to guess and was opportunistic and just gave some answer in order to gain favor with the king, you could have, I mean, heads could have rolled as well, in a very literal sense. Verse 8. Now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing, or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled, his countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. You know, the lesson here is that they were partying as their enemies were making siege. Because everybody thought that, you know, Babylon is so powerful. We have defenses, and they had accumulated enough stores of food to last for years. So, hey, you know, we will live in Babylon and party, even though our enemies on the outside are preparing to make war. It is never a good idea to underestimate the power of the enemy. Because in doing so, you lose your vigilance, and we'll get to in a minute how they how the Chaldeans managed to take it over. It was a new, different, and innovative way. Enemies are good at coming up with things like that, and most of all, you know, our enemy is able to do that in ways that we don't expect. You know, humanly, whenever we or the church has been attacked, what do you do? You build a defense for that methodology. Well, next time it's probably going to be different. Here they are, partying away, having a great time, and using God's utensils to do it. I mean, this is why these stories are timeless. It's a classic. Verse 10, the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall, and the queen spoke, saying, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. I mean, come on. What's the big deal? I've got a solution for you. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God, and in the days of your father, again referring to Nebuchadnezzar, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him, and King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. Now this, a lot of time it transpired. It is estimated that at this time Daniel was about 80 years old. He had become an old man. But his reputation was still known by the queen. Belshazzar had apparently chosen to ignore or forget it, and Daniel was no longer in a position of power, at least not next to the king. Continuing in verse 13. Well, before we do that, I want to draw a modern parallel. You know, in Romans chapter 1, it talks about people refusing, why don't we turn back there, refusing to retain God in their knowledge. Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. But what do we do? What do the learned, the intellectuals, do today? Even though God's invisible attributes are clearly seen by the things that they have made, what have we done? We have substituted God for nature. Choosing to believe that everything that we see here somehow evolved by itself by natural phenomenon. Oh, we pay lip service to God, don't we? In political speeches, you know, God bless America. I wonder what God thinks. Well, I think I know what he thinks. I believe that those kinds of expressions, in the contexts that they are given by individuals who do not believe God. Notice I said believe God, not believe in God. That is more often a case of breaking the commandment of taking God's name in vain. You know, we generally think of it as profanity, and indeed that's true. But taking God's name in vain can be done in many other ways. And I would submit that it's being done repeatedly. And I think we're headed on a collision course. much as Belshazzar was, because he appropriated the utensils of God's temple to throw a party without regard for the fact that God is the one that gave him the position of power that he enjoyed at that time. Today we do the same. You know, we say, God bless America. You know, we invite God and we invoke the name of God. We use his, if you'll allow me to say this, his utensils. We're appropriating terminology from the Bible and the temple of God to make what we are doing politically and otherwise more attractive to the masses. And yet we deny that he had any involvement in the creation that we see around us. I mean, I'm not against education or learning, on the contrary. But it befuddles me on how intelligent people can believe that everything you see that is so consistent and complex could have evolved by random chance. The only way that you can make a case for it is to spread it out over a development period that involves millions and billions of years. Because then you can argue that it had enough, if enough time transpires, things can evolve to a higher state, and all the evidence is to the contrary. What do you know that gets better without the conscious intellectual involvement of designers and developers and engineers, artisans and craftsmen? We see here in verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. What Paul is writing to the Romans here, centuries later, very concisely describes where Belshazzar and his thousand lords were at on that fateful night when the amputated hand came into the room and wrote. I would submit to you that it also typifies where we're at as a nation. You know, we think the United States is so powerful. And, you know, we talk about the fiscal cliff that is before us like, it's just another thing, you know, I mean, and people are so tired of hearing all the political things that are going on that it's like, oh, well, it's just another political game in Washington. And I mean, I can understand that dilemma. But when you look at the numbers, 43 cents of every dollar the federal government spends is borrowed. You know, we were the indisputable, and I guess you could say from a military standpoint, we are still the indisputable most powerful nation on the earth. Until somebody drains the swamp. We'll get to that in a minute. Notice in verse 23, and change the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Therefore, and then it goes into what God turned them over to. isn't it astonishing that while we claim to be, to have a political system in which human rights are valued, we have the contradictory position of killing the most vulnerable. At the same time that we nearly worship certain animals, birds and reptiles, to the point, you know, California is famous for it, where saving a species takes precedent over the interests of man. Now, I believe in dressing and keeping the garden. That was God's initial command. But we are also to have dominion. So we kill our unborn and save unfertilized eggs of certain turtles to make up an example. Back to Daniel. Verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you." Now, the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you, that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now if, back, now if, you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Appealing in every case to the ego of the individual. A purple robe. Now, I don't care for purple that much. A gold chain, well, at least you could melt that down and turn it into something. But it had all, I mean, they were symbols of power and prestige. And Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another." This is illustrative of Daniel's character. He didn't want to be paid. Daniel saw the nonsense that was going on and knew it would be short-lived. "Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation." Now, it's interesting because here we are at verse 18. It took him until verse 25 to get to the interpretation. And notice the message that he had for King Belshazzar. "O King, Most High God, O King, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor." Transfer that to today. We have been given by God an opportunity to live in freedom for over two centuries. Because, among other things, the founders of this country acknowledged, unabashedly acknowledged the providence of God. And while they were ambitious young men with all kinds of motives, no doubt, that central premise help them to get it mostly right. Or, I should say, right enough that many people have benefited over a long period of time by the kingdom that they set up. Nebuchadnezzar, likewise, was empowered by God. He was given the kingdom. God used Nebuchadnezzar to punish his people because they had gone astray. But God, not playing favorites, as we read in the previous chapters, in due course humbled Nebuchadnezzar to the point that he acknowledged the sovereignty of God. He, however, did not seem to have successfully passed that to the next generations. Verse 19, and because of the majesty he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. That describes pretty much the situation or the reaction to the United States of America in the past 100 years. Oh, they say a lot of things, but in a nutshell, all peoples, languages, and nations tremble at the U.S. of A. And they want to come here. They really want to come here. I've been talking to several Indian computer programming companies, and they want to come here. Life's good here. Even though we think, okay, I mean, things are not as good as they should be, it's all a matter of comparison. And they do come here, you know, through the laptop these days. It's getting pretty easy with the technology we have to have somebody sit anywhere. In fact, we did that last week. We had some things that needed to be set up on a particular program. Took about a half an hour. No, it took an hour. And a technician was in India. It's no different from calling Microsoft in Washington. Their technician's not going to come to your office either. You're going to do it remotely. The U.S. is still a nation that people fear and tremble of. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. You know, it's really, really difficult for anyone, any nation or any organization to keep from becoming arrogant when you have been given this much. It's just very difficult to have that restraint. But when his heart was lifted up, see, here's the problem, and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And here he's, you know, I'm going to get to the hand over there that have caused your knees to knock and buckle, but let me tell you something first. Keep your gifts. Let's get to the lesson. And I think that's very important with prophecy in particular. I mean, prophetic events and all that it tells us about the future is very important because it provides a vision and a roadmap and hope that as bad as it might get, ultimately God is sovereign and he will have it his way in the end. The kingdom will be established. We will rule with him. The righteous will inherit the kingdom of God. In the end, it'll be made right. That's all important, but in nearly every prophecy, except for several chapters that are prophetic and framework in nature, that are specifically talking about sequence of events, for the most part, you have embedded into the prophecy here a far greater issue. And the greater issue here is how it impacts individuals and nations. And the lessons to be learned from it is what happens in how you or the nation responds or responded. But when Nebuchadnezzar's heart was lifted up and his pride was hardened, his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men, his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. Here you have a guy sitting on his throne with his knees shaking because of the vision, the hand that he had just seen. And the man of God comes to give him the interpretation, but first comes the lesson. The lesson had priority. Verse 22, "But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this." So while Belshazzar, in his introduction to Daniel, kind of says, well, you know, I have heard that you can do these things, and kind of made light of what he knew, Daniel got right to the point. You knew. He was not politically correct. You know, we see all this pandering going on at all kinds of levels where people are backslapping and patting each other on the back. And you never get to the heart of the issue. Daniel did. Belshazzar, despite of the fact that he knew that his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had been deposed from his kingdom for a period of 7 years, who had at multiple times acknowledged the God Most High, chose to party when the nation was under siege instead of looking to God for help. And it cost him the kingdom. And history repeats itself. You know, whenever we think we've got it made and throw a party, we're living very dangerously. He knew, but didn't do. "And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven." How did he do that? "They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your mistresses and girlfriends." Not much has changed, has it? "Have drunk wine from them." God be with us as we party, as we are subservient to the gods of gold, silver, and bronze. Wall Street parties, and Main Street is expected to pay. It's wrong. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. Just look at that. Look at the brilliance of what Daniel said from a scientific standpoint. The gods that they were worshiping were inanimate objects. I mean, wood. Wood does not feel or know. Neither does stone, neither does the element gold. I mean, gold is elemental. I mean, if you boil it down. And yet, that is what he praised. We do the same thing today, albeit in more sophisticated manner. We praise the stock market. And we worship it. When in reality, it is a house of cards. And if you look at the construct and, you know, the relative value of our dollar bill. In fact, you may have seen this news report. There is a proposal with Congress to dispense with the dollar because it's costing too much. You know, dollar bills wear out pretty fast. So they're looking at coming up with reinstituting a dollar coin, not the silver dollar, because if you take silver at $30 an ounce and try to make silver dollars, I mean, no, it'll just be zinc that is nickel plated, so you can make it for about 5 or 10 cents a piece. And then, you know, people exchange the currency. I mean, the dollar really has no value when it comes right down to it, other than the fact that merchants and people and you and I are willing to exchange goods and services. It's a medium of exchange. That's all it is. And it only works so long as the next person is willing to accept that medium of exchange for your goods or services. Real value, real wealth is in real stuff. But 401ks, I mean, never mind that they're now 101ks. You want to excite somebody, you know, you talk to them about their 401k. We're back to worshiping the same gods. We work very hard for these gods. And a God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. I have a good friend of mine down our way that just published a book called Business with a Higher Purpose. It's written by Paul Weaver. Paul Weaver recounts in that book the lessons he has learned in the last 40 years of the existence of that company, which is now the number one leather product manufacturer in the United States as it relates to the equestrian market. And 32 years ago, his father, who owned the company, it was a small saddle shop in Mount Hope, Ohio, died unexpectedly and left Paul, a 28-year-old man, at the helm. And he recounts, on the morning of his father's funeral, having taken a walk and making a deal with God. And the deal he made was that he knew he was on a scale of 1 to 10, he was maybe a 5 in being prepared to do what he knew he needed to do. So he asked God that if God would bless him, if he would give him wisdom, and if he would bring people into his life, that all he could offer in return was to give him 1/10 of all the profits and 1/10 of his personal income from that. It is a very compelling story. He acknowledges today unabashedly that Weaver Leather Products is where it is at because of that, of the faithfulness of God to that deal at a time when he obviously was grieving and wondering how he might go forward. You know, contrast that to here. Belshazzar was a powerful, look, I mean, we're in Babylon. We have gathered in food. I mean, we'll starve out the oppressive armies that are at our door. Now he gets to the interpretation. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this is written, this writing was written, and this is the inscription that was written. Mina, Mina, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Mina. God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tegel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. What was his reaction? Did he, like David, say, I have sinned? No, he said. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and a close Daniel was purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. He didn't get it, did he? That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. You know, Herodotus records the strategy. Herodotus mentions that Cyrus, after laying siege to the town, entered it by the bed of the Euphrates that ran through the town. You just have your engineers go upstream and build a dam. Wait till dusk, shut the gate, the water goes down, and what happens? All the walls that you've got, all the food that you've got stored, and all the guards you have on top of the walls, and the big gates that are secured mean nothing. His army walked right in to the city through the riverbed. What's interesting is that Herodotus also confirms the account of Daniel in saying, having drained off its waters, and that the capture took place whilst the Babylonians were feasting. A Greek historian writing in the 4th century before Christ also mentions the siege, the draining of the Euphrates, and the feast. And so this great king lives in infamy down through time to this day. And it comes down to the central issue of whether or not he accepted God as sovereign in his life. Now, of course, we could wax eloquent about our nation's situation, and we should be watching. But the real question, the real lesson of Daniel chapter 5 is, whether God can speak to us or whether we allow God to speak to us through His written word. And we in turn respond with a willing heart and apply, as in the example that I cited of a friend of mine, what we know. You know, Paul Weaver, at that time, and I was thinking back because, you know, today tithing is a comparatively well-known concept and preached by many mainstream churches. 32 years ago, that was not the case. That was a radical idea at that time. And, you know, I'll see him this next Thursday, and I thought about it. I want to sit down and ask him how he came to that conclusion. Because, like I said, at that time, most churches did not espouse tithing at all. It appears, and what I guess to be a case, because he's a very passionate individual and bold in his own way, I'm guessing he read it in the Bible and decided, you know what, I'm going to try this. The thought I'd like to leave with you today is, do God's words move us to action? Or are we waiting for a hand to write it on our wall?